Well, hello, hello, and welcome once again to a Beatles program that we call Things We Said Today. This is a weekly show in which we talk about what's going on news-wise in the world of the Beatles. I'm Ken Michaels, one of the co-hosts of the show, and some of you know me for another Beatles program that I host called Every Little Thing. I'm joined by my co-host, as always, the man who writes for Beatles Examiner and many Examiner columns, that being Steve Marinucci. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Ken. Hello, everybody.
On today's show, we have another special guest with us on the phone. And if I was to ask you the question, who has been the music director for Ringo Starr and his all-star band more than anybody else, it would be our special guest, who is Mark Rivera. Hi, Mark, and welcome to Things We Said Today.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you, Steve. It's good to be on.
We have Mark on the phone with us because he has a brand new CD that he's released, and it's called Common Bond. And I've already interviewed Mark privately, and so has Steve, actually, in the past. In fact, he's written a review recently in Beatles Examiner for the new album. We both have been raving about it. And we just want to talk for a while about the new album and find out how long have you been working on this album?
Let me see. I'm 61, so about 75 years. I'm not quite 60. The actual project took about a year, a little over a year to finalize. And then with distribution, we waited till we had the right group of people. But, I mean, I wrote one of the songs with Jimmy Brelauer, my producer and co-writer, probably 26 years ago. When I did Sledgehammer with Peter Gabriel, we wrote a song, the song Hard to Let Go. We wrote that trying to have that kind of a mood. So that goes back, I did the album 86. Mm. It was probably written in 87, maybe 88. So that's a couple of years.
Yeah. Before we continue, I really should give our listeners more of a background on you, because I only mentioned Ringo, but you have such an impressive resume. You go back to touring with Sam and Dave, as you've told me. Foreigner. You were in the band for how many years?
About on and off between different tours, probably from 1980 till about 1994, I think, was the last date that I played with them.
Yeah.
Yeah, so 14 years on and off.
Right.
Yep.
Of course, most people outside of the Beatle fans, and many of the Beatle fans, know you for your work with Billy Joel.
That's been going on for quite a while, 32 years now.
That is, in and of itself, a story.
that really is. Congratulations, Mark.
Well, thank you. In fact, Billy is currently doing, they're releasing, I believe in May, the Bridge box set DVD and our tour of Russia, and that's the place in 1987, and I am the last remaining member of the band from that tour, which
wow.
I'm proud of. Saddened by some, I mean, the fact that Doug is gone and some very dear friends but are not there, but I'm proud to be with Billy this long.
Yeah, and currently doing a tour with him, and you do have residency at Madison Square Garden once a month.
Yes.
So,
yes, we do.
At least I know. I'm comfortable knowing that you're always going to be in town near me.
Yes, I'm at your beck and call. I'm nearby.
Hey, you could be my co-host.
I could be. You know, then I'll have a real job.
None of us have a real job. That's the truth.
Well, that's the really? Exact point.
Uh-huh. Tell me a little bit about Jimmy Brelauer. He is the producer for the new album, and you've had a relationship with him for quite a long time. Give us a little background on him.
Jimmy and I met years ago. We played in a band called Trouble with this guy named Jimmy Frank. Jimmy and I did the whole scene in Manhattan. We worked about five or seven different clubs constantly. We'd run around. He played drums. That was his gig originally. And then as time went on, he saw the handwriting on the wall with all the electronic music and the sequencers. He was one of the first people, if not the first person, to beta test a Lin drum machine. And he's got an extensive resume from, I could just pick a couple, Stevie Winwood. He and I both played on Peter Gabriel's So. He's worked with Eric Clapton. He's done tons of work with Nile Rodgers, Chic, and all the, Jim Steinman productions with Meatloaf. I mean, I can't even begin. Madonna, Celine Dion, just to name a few. I feel like I'm dropping names. But Jimmy's background is extensive. And he and I had been friends forever. We'd always find each other. We'd walk past each other at the power station or at the hit factory or at the record plant. He'd be doing one record. I'll be doing another record. And about 2 years ago, Jimmy said, "Hey, buddy, it's time for you to do your record." And I'm like, "Well, I don't know." He said, "You've been saying I don't know for now over 2 decades. So it's his fault. I'm going to blame him for everything. So he basically convinced me that I had a potential to do to make a great record, and thank goodness I listened to him, and I'm very proud of this.
Where did the name come from, Common Bond, Mark?
Common Bond to me is the sense of commonality I have in my musical background. Some of the songs, first of all, I covered a Jimi Hendrix song, I covered a Fleetwood Mac song, but some of my favorite music from back in that day was Traffic, which one of the songs, Start Over, I think, is reminiscent of that. There's some R&B roots. There's some... It's a collection. What I have in common in the gathering of all my common musical genres, and the fact that I was able to ask very dear friends. I asked Billy Joel. I asked Ringo. I asked Mills Lofgren, Steve Lukather, would you play on my record? And each one said yes, and there was a thread that just went through. And I just thought, Common Bond. And as it turns out, my son was an architecture major at Virginia Tech, and he said, "Yeah, Dad, Common Bond, that's cool. That's how when people make a house, the bricklayers lay the brick off-center, and it's Common Bond, and it keeps it stronger." And I thought to myself, wow, that's even cooler. It's a sense of making something to last, so... It just seemed like a natural thought for what I was hoping to create with this record.
Who's on the album besides Ringo and Billy?
There's the rhythm section is Charlie Drayton, who's played with a ton of people, and he's well known for his work with Keith Richards. He and Steve Jordan switched off between bass and drums. He played with Keith. He played with Fiona Apple. He played with Paul Simon. He was the hardest guy to nail down for rehearsal, and as well as the actual recording. But I'm very pleased that I waited. There's Charlie Drayton, Steve Conte on guitar. He's played with the Dolls. He's played with Eric Burton. His brother John Conte, Jeff Kazee played keyboards, and the other co-writer on a lot of the material is Johnny Gale. He was the glue of a lot of the rhythm section stuff. Johnny and Jimmy had worked together on a Ryan Shaw record for some time. I don't know if you're familiar with Ryan, but aside from that, Will Lee played bass on one song. Robert Randolph played on a song. I'm trying to think if there's any. Catherine Sutton sang backgrounds on one of the songs. I think I've named everybody. just to name a few. And, of course, the co-writer Karen Mano, a great songwriter who wrote the beautiful closing song, Rise. So, that's about all I have to say about that.
It's such an impressive lineup of musicians right there. I do want to say about the production, I think it's just superb. I mean, apart from loving the songs, I think the mix is just so perfect because every musician gets to shine at their own instrument when it's necessary.
That's very kind of you to say, and quite frankly, I have to give complete kudos to Jimmy Brailauer. I go in there and play a guitar part, and I go in there and play a sax part, and I go in and play a vocal or whatever I did, and I'm like, "Hey, I gotta go do a gig." And he'd work literally hundreds and hundreds of hours. I mean, I don't even want to tell you how many hours. He might even say hundreds, more like 1,000. It was the truest labor of love. I've never seen anyone so delve so deeply into a project. And he'd call me late at night, "Hey, buddy, got another mix for you." And he'd have like 5 mixes of the song. And I'm like, "What am I listening for?" He goes, "Well, you didn't notice I took the guitar back here." But you're absolutely right, Ken. There are situations where you clear out a little bit of the sonic area. So the frequencies would come through, and all of a sudden you hear the Hammond B3 growl. or you hear this Barry Sachs come through. He gave clarity. Oh, and one more person, Andy York, John Mellencamp's guitarist, is also on the record. Just came to me because that was one of the things. We had like six guitar different parts on different guitar parts, and he would just like clear the clutter. And it's very kind of you, Sam. I'm going to make sure Jimmy hears you, that you said that, because he deserves all the credit for this. To say to be, I'm going beyond humility. I'm going to direct fact. You did such an amazing job, and I thank you for that compliment.
Well, I really think you did a superb job. I got to ask you, because you're someone who impresses me as somebody who has such a deep appreciation for a lot of different styles of music and so many different types of musicians that are out there. When it came to picking the cover songs, Spanish Castle Magic, Jimi Hendrix, and you also did Tell Me All the Things You Do, Fleetwood Mac song, I'm sure there's so many songs you'd love to cover. How did you pick? How did you narrow it down to those two?
Spanish Castle Magic, as far as the raw energy of a song, is my favorite Jimi Hendrix song. As far as the philosophical point of Jimi Hendrix, which people don't usually think about, If Six Were Nine is my favorite song, and Castles Made of Sand, because it kind of says what you think is not necessarily what is. But as far as raw energy, I love Spanish Castle Magic. I saw Hendrix play that two or three different times in New York, and I always wanted to play it. As far as Tell Me All the Things You Do, it was one of those songs I played in a band when I was in Brooklyn years ago, and the Fleetwood Mac album.
Kiln House, exactly.
And I covered those songs. I did that one, Station Man, from that record. I just always dug this song, and it basically... it was an excuse to play, and it was the first song we cut to get the band flowing. And that's how that all worked out. We also covered, we tried to cover, and I'll say totally, I wanted to do Tomorrow Never Knows, because that's probably my favorite Beatles song, and my favorite Beatles album is Revolver. And Ringo actually said that it was his as well, but I wasn't allowed to ever say that, but I just did, so he'll hang me now. But the sound of that record, to me, that's when Jeff Emmerich first recorded the Beatles. It was the first time he engineered any of the sessions. And the first song that he ever did, I'm sure you know this, was Tomorrow Never Knows.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's just incredibly explosive. So we tried to cover that, and Jimmy Breslau looked at me. He said, because we had a long take of it, we just played through it. He said, buddy, it's a real nice exercise, but you're never going to do what the Beatles did. So then I tried to do another cover of it, like playing this real detuned guitars and droning with Chasm and myself. And that was close, but it still never cut the mustard. So, and then we did cut, and we may do it eventually on an EP of It Don't Come Easy. It's kind of like Ringo meets Neil Young's Cinnamon Girl. But it's just a different twist. But those songs, the short answer, there's so much great music out there, and this band, I wanted to hear Charlie play Spanish Castle Magic. It's kind of like my own little, I have Charlie Drake. What will I ask him to play?
Yeah. I got to tell you, though, I love the guitar playing from Steve Conte on Tell Me All the
Steve
Things
Conte's
You Do.
He's a monster.
You know, it's got such a great groove, that song.
I agree. That's a wonderful cover. Wonderful.
I thank you. And I'll tell you, talking about aggressive guitar, his solo on Turn Me Loose is one of the best. I mean, Steve Lukather heard that about a year ago. He said, dude, who's that guitar player? I'm a fan. He's like so into it. And I told Conte that. He goes, yeah, Steve and I knew each other, because he said he liked me. He's like, really, again, these guys are all, we're all so like insecure. It goes beyond humility. It's like, really, he liked it? So, but Steve's great. In fact, I have a gig coming up March 27th at the Cutting Room.
And I'll be there.
Out of sight. Mm-hmm. Out of sight. And the band is going to be Steve Conte on guitar, Charlie Drayton on drums, Johnny Gale's playing second guitar, or they're going to be whoever's playing first or second guitar is irrelevant. Those two wonderful guitar players. Zef Katz, bass player extraordinaire, is going to be playing bass. And my very dear friend from Evergo, Bette Sussman, will be playing keyboards. And the band is like stellar, and I'm really looking. Those are the five people I have, like, talk about herding cats to get them to figure out what we could rehearse.
Yeah, that's a smoking band right there. I can't wait to see it.
I can't wait to throw it down.
that's going to be great. Let me ask a question, Mark, about if we could talk about Ringo and the All-Star Band. I know I asked Edgar Winter this question a couple of years ago, what kind of boss is Ringo as far as the All-Star Band goes? Does each man in the band have their choice of songs, or does Ringo pick them? How does that work?
Ringo, first and foremost, is the most fair human being I've ever met in my life. It's basically his only criteria for picking songs is that they were hits. He'd like to play the hits that people know, but he also wants to play the songs that are fun for the particular band. And I kind of go in between, the hit versus the... I'm a fan, and I'll give you a perfect example. When Greg Lake was in the band, Carnival 9 was a lock. Lucky Man was a lock, and I think he wanted to do From the Beginning. And I looked over to Greg while Ringo was there, I said, well, what about The Court of the Crimson King? And Greg was like, oh, that'll never work. No, no one would ever remember. I said, dude, I'm a huge fan, and that was class. That's true rock and roll history. Ian McDonald. It was one of those times that if you were conscious. That was like, I hate to say, but it was such a drug influenced record. It was like it had such heavy connotations. But The Court of the Crimson King was such a trip, and I won't say he fought tooth and nail, but it took a little bit of heavy lifting to convince him to let's try it. So we try it, and Ringo does his first three songs, and the first song after Ringo's video is, and now I'd like to introduce Greg Lake. And all of a sudden, the whole audience is like almost in tears. Because anybody who was around that time, I pat myself on the back. That was one of the best calls of my career with Ringo, because people loved it, and it was just the one that nobody was going to call. So with that said, I guess the short answer is Ringo is the ultimate, he wants to make the greatest sounding band ever. And everybody gets their pick. It's like we everyone got three songs. And, of course, you want to pick the highest chart position songs. But in that case, I said, this is a song that people who are the real fans are going to freak out. And it worked. I mean, Edgar always did Frankenstein and Free Ride, and there was, I'm trying to think if there was a third song, because there might have been five front people in that band. But you pick your highest chart positions, and I hope I'm not going too far off the subject, but Ringo is the most present human being I've ever known in my life. John was the same way when I worked with John for a short time. They were so aware. It's like they had this like 360 vision. You didn't know how they saw what was coming around from behind them. But as far as being in the moment on stage, that's just what Ringo is and what John was. So I hope I kind of answered the question, Steve.
You did. Thank you, Mark. Ken?
I wanted to ask you, and actually I wanted to bounce a little bit off of what Steve said and what you just said. The process of picking the new members for the All-Stars, how exactly does that work?
Who is the agent, Dave Hart, has come to me for years now, and he'd come to me and say, dude, we got to do this, we need to get that, we need to get a new guitar player. Ringo likes to keep it fresh. This, in fact, is the first time ever that the same band has gone out for four separate tours ever. Ringo loves this band, but the process basically would be who would fit into the groove. Aside from the music, it has to be a personality thing, because there have been a couple of clashes that I won't mention, but things do happen, and you have to realize that when you're dealing with a Beatle, I'll give you a funny little example, nothing negative. Jack Bruce and Peter Frampton, we were all talking about, we were on a plane heading to the next gig, and Jack mentioned, I remember that record, I think we sold like 12 million, and Peter said, we did 17 million on that, and we did 30 of it. And then they ask Ringo, and how many records do you think he saw? He goes, half a billion. And he's like, everybody's like, okay, I'll go sit in the corner now, you know? And what it is you have to hang your ego up at the door. So you bring the music, you have to fit in with the group, and the songs have to be fun. Ringo doesn't want to, you know, watch paint dry. He wants to get up there and have a great time. And as far as the choice of musicians, great songs, great attitude, and that's pretty much the criteria. I mean, there's not much more. If you think about it, when we were kids, when we were younger in a band, you wanted to go hang out with guys who were cool. You wanted to play great music. All the bands I was ever in, I played covers. That's what we did as a kid. And then you grow up, you start writing material, and realize how difficult it really is. Mm-hmm. But this is about, Ringo's about getting the best guys together to make the best sound for the best band. I remember one time he said, I'm just a drummer in the band. I said, you just happen to be the drummer of the greatest band ever, but that's besides the point.
Mm.
So, but he's very much a band person, and he's obviously, as you both know, as you've studied him or you've been so involved in his music, he's the greatest song drummer ever. Ever. I mean, there's nobody who played a song that did more. It's also, you got to give a little credit to that guy, John and Paul, for writing those incredible songs, because those songs had to be dealt with a certain way, because they were little pieces of music. They were pieces of music, so there's to it. And Ringo just did them the ultimate service that they sounded like no other drummer would have ever played. So
I agree, you know.
And that's all I got to say about that.
Yeah. I was going to say he knew how to compliment the song.
Oh, absolutely. There was no one, there is no one like him. I don't believe so.
Getting back to answering the question, did you kind of say that you kind of filter who the new musicians would be? Do you help decide that?
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, they throw a musician at me, and I just know that it was wrong. And I won't give any cases and points, but let's say you have a nucleus. You have Ringo, you have Greg Bizanet, who I love, and for some time now, Richard Page has been the bass player. So we needed a guitar player, a keyboard player, or two guitars and a keyboard. And when they first mentioned Greg Raleigh, I'm like, I don't know. I got to think about this. And then I thought about it for a second. I thought, these amazing, soulful songs being played by Steve Lukather. And I said, really? You had to think about that? So that just came together. There have been situations where I didn't think it would work, and it did. And there have been situations where I thought might not be the best, and it wasn't. They're just hit and miss. I mean, that's why some guys last for one tour, and some guys have lasted six or seven tours.
Huh. Well, I wanted to comment about, because you were mentioning Greg Lake before. To me,
uh-huh.
Because I love great singers, and to me, Roger Hodgson mm-hmm. is one of the greatest.
I love Roger.
To have that tour with him and Greg Lake and Howard Jones and Sheila E.,
mm-hmm.
you would look at a list like that and say, these musicians, how could they connect? They're different decades, different styles.
Eddie and Hunter to that. Eddie and Hunter to that.
Yeah.
What are you, crazy? That's, in fact, it's funny you mentioned that, because I did say that. I said, I don't know about this. And sure enough, we got together, and it was magic. It was really magic.
You know, some lineups look very strange on paper, but then you watch it, and mm-hmm. it's amazing to combine in the court of the Crimson King with the glamorous life. I mean,
exactly. You couldn't, you know, you would think there's no way this could possibly happen, and you're absolutely right, Ken. It takes a while, but it's incredible. I mean, some of the lineups, when I first heard them, I'm thinking to myself, wow, this guy really just wants to put a band together because he just wants to put this band out there. But what it comes down to, the more eclectic it was, the more bang for buck anybody came to see a show, because you had five bands that you were hearing the creme de la creme.
Mm-hmm.
Getting 10 or 12 Ringo songs, Beatle Ringo songs. Then he had two or three songs each of these other four musicians. It was like going to five concerts in one. And I'm sure everyone says that, or you felt the same way. Am I correct, both of you,
mm-hmm.
Steve?
Yeah.
Ken?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, you know, I love all the lineups, but that's the most memorable for me. I like eclecticism. You know, uh-huh. there are probably some people who prefer the Jack Bruce, Gary Brooker, Peter Frampton.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
I love
no,
that,
I remember. I remember that, Ken. And that one has a big memory for me, as does the... the first bands with when Billy Preston was there.
Oh yeah, yeah man. No,
but the, I'll tell you the one name that comes to mind, and you mentioned her just now, was Sheila E.
Uh-huh.
That was her two tours with the band were just amazing, and
yeah.
And I've been one. I keep hoping that at some point she's going to come back. Is there any chance that she might come back?
I can't say that I know anything about crystal ball, but I don't think so.
Okay.
Because I think Greg Bissonette, basically, Greg and Ringo are so solid together. Greg knows when Ringo accidentally hit his, when he dropped the stick in a recording, if he ever did. Greg studies Ringo so precisely. And Ringo loves Greg, and it's a mutual thing. That doesn't mean what I could see happen someday, and I don't think it's out of turn to speak, would be the best of the all-stars, and have a band with three guitar players, have a Peter Frampton come back, have a, you mentioned Roger Hodgson, you mentioned, there's some amazing musicians that have passed through this band.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, a fair amount of them are no longer with us, from Levon to Danko to Billy Preston, and John Entwistle. I mean, the first band that I ever played with Ringo was Zach Starkey played drums, Randy Bachman, Mark Farner, mm-hmm. Felix Cavalieri, and unfortunately, John Entwistle and Billy Preston, who have both passed.
Right.
Right.
I remember that tour, too. That was a great tour.
You know, it's so difficult because it's like children. You know, I have two sons, and I love them both more than air. And you can't say you love one more than the other. But there's certain things one will do, I remember he did that. But I've been with nine different incarnations of this band, and the ones that stick out to me, I still have to say this current lineup, for my own druthers, is my favorite because the musicality is like nothing I've ever heard. People doing their homework. But I'm with you on the Jack Bruce and Peter Frampton tour. I mean, I also got to play. I got to play the organ on "White as Shade of Pale" next to Gary Brooker every night.
Mm.
How much fun was I having?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then you talk about the same band with Sheila E. and Roger and Howard Jones. Howard Jones played "Carnival 9," which has more synths and keyboards and stuff on two keyboards. I forget what they call it, like a master keyboard, and a little Casio. He had a little Casio to extend like two octaves that he couldn't get on the other stuff. But he played everything, and she killed that. I remember watching her from behind stage one time, a silhouette on the scrim.
Right.
And it was like watching something out of the Muppets. It was insane. And that band too sticks out in my mind. So,
if anything, what you're saying, it gives you a deeper appreciation for all the musicians in that band because you wouldn't associate Sheila E. with a song like "Carnival 9."
No kidding.
You know, and she nails it the same way Howard Jones nails it. That's the beauty of it all.
Yep.
And I also think the same thing with Edgar Winter, the one with his tours with the band. I mean, he was...
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Just amazing. I mean, Edgar is one of the true... I mean, he's one of the most talented human beings I've ever, ever met. I love him as a friend and as a player. He's deep. He's just deep. He's got such he's expansive. He's got the most incredible scope of music of anyone I know. He'll play bebop. He'll play funk. He turned me on to this guy. Israel Holton, I think his name is. Tremendous gospel singer. And then he'll turn around and play bebop. And then he'll turn around and play one of my favorite bands of all time. When I was a kid, I saw White Trash open up for Emerson, Lake & Palmer.
Mm.
White Trash killed the night. It was, I'll never forget. I said, how is that possible? And then, wah! I mean, between Edgar and Jerry LaCroix, it was like, I wanted to be in that band. I wanted to have a band that had that type of intensity. And look, Edgar, you have to kind of bow. I'm almost like namaste. It's like he's an incredible human being and a gift. He's really a gift to have as a friend.
Mm.
So wow. The funny thing is, as we're talking here, I mean, I appreciate Ringo mostly from as a friend from this whole thing started because of him and three other lads from Liverpool. But as I'm speaking to you, the introductions that he's made for me and the bridges to the lifelong friends that he's made, I would never have had these relationships without him, never. Mm-hmm. And I'm more grateful for his friendship and for what he's given me in that respect than anything. I mean, again, you talk about common bond. These things come out because of that. It's just that.
Yeah, you've met a lot of great musicians through the All-Stars.
Oh yeah.
That's definitely true. I think if I don't ask this question, a lot of people are going to say, why didn't you ask? But I have to ask about the night that Paul McCartney surprised everybody at Shea Stadium, because I remember watching that and hearing the news right after it happened, and then seeing the video and hearing the screams, and it was amazing. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about that, Mark?
Of course. Yeah, I'd love to. We didn't know if he was going to make it because he flew in from London. He was on a flight, and we had, an 11:30 curfew or something. We had to be done at a certain time, and for that matter, the set was going on so long. We only had so many songs prepared for that night. We were done, and we had played a couple of nights before, and it was about 140 degrees. It was stifling, and we were all melting on stage. And we came up for the first encore. I'm like, the plane just landed. I'm like, oh, man, the plane just landed. He'll never get here. As it turns out, the plane landed, and they got from the tarmac. They had driven him straight out of there through customs like it didn't matter. He had the Hofner, as we call the Mona Lisa, with him, and he just came directly backstage as we were drying up for the second encore. He fixed his black tie and came up. It was like within 15, maybe 20 minutes from the time the plane landed, and it was like, is he here? We don't know. Is he here? We don't know. We knew he wanted to try to make it, and he landed, and it was all over. It was incredible. It was just incredible. And then Billy, the ultimate, I mean, you talk about total class, closing Shea Stadium. He packed two nights of over 120,000 people. And what does he do? He tells Paul McCartney, no, you close this set. Who would do that but a gentleman? Mm-hmm. It was one of, I'll never forget that, because it was the last song played at Shea Stadium, and it was Paul closing it out. It blows my mind to this day how that happened.
Those are two people that I wish would do more work together, especially in the studio. It would be a dream come true. There's a lot of similarities,
Well, I would love to have the two of them do like what Billy and Elton did. I mean, Billy and Paul would be insane. That would be, to me, that'd be like, I wouldn't even know what to do. To play with Paul's band as well. I love Abe, and I'm good friends with Wick, so you never know.
Hmm.
We'll see.
I just wanted to ask, when it came to the All-Stars, when you had rehearsals, when you were ironing out the songs that you were going to do on each tour, were there any songs that were big hits and you thought, oh, definitely, we're going to go with this, and for some reason it didn't work?
Not really. I mean, certain people would try to rearrange the songs, and I'd hate it, but that's just my choice. That's my opinion. But, we constantly ask Ringo, would you play this song? Would you play Octopus's Garden? Would you play All My Mind? Nah, I'm bored. I don't want to. He keeps saying about Octopus's Garden. He goes, there's Yellow Submarine, and there's this. He goes, what do they want? They think I live underwater? I can't remember any song that didn't work that was a flop.
Okay.
There were songs that we didn't know. They talk about like little gems that all of a sudden we hadn't thought of, and just came out, and they worked. I'm trying to think of any in particular. I remember when Eric Cartman was in the band, who has short-lived, but Jack Bruce and he had their moments, because Go All The Way had a song, as Jack said, you have a chord for every damn word you're saying, and he's going on and on. But as it turns out, we did Go All The Way, and the crowd went nuts. So it was a three-minute song, but the people absolutely loved it. And that, I was a Raspberries fan, but I didn't think it was going to get the reception it did. And c'est la vie.
Hey, a lot of Beatle fans are Raspberries fans. So.
Oh, absolutely. Listen to Go All The Way. I mean, it's like one. It sounded like Badfinger. It had a sense of like, it had all the right elements. It was like, don't bore us, get to the chorus. It was like, like 9 seconds into the song, you're saying, go all the way.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like, it's crazy. It's crazy how much of a hit that was.
Are you going to make any set changes for the upcoming, for the summer tour, Mark?
If I have my way, I'm going to swap out one of Todd's songs.
Okay.
because I'm a fan of where Todd came from, but I'm not going to say any more than that.
Okay. How about Ringo?
Ringo, I'm trying to get him to do All My My. I hope he'll do like 16 again. He wants to do I'm the Greatest, but I think personally, I'd rather hear All My My. I'd love to have him do Octopus's Garden, because I don't think he's ever done that except for the Roundheads.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be cool. And the rest of the band, I think maybe Luke would like to do a different song than Africa, but who knows? We'll see. We'll see. But I definitely have my mind set on one song by Todd, and it's
okay.
Actually before he called himself Todd.
Exactly.
So that should give you an idea how far back I'm going.
Is there a chance that Ringo's album will be out before the summer tour, or do you know?
Very possibly. I know. I believe Luke, and Ringo are writing together, which I'm really anxious to hear.
Yeah,
really looking forward to hearing that. It could be. I mean, Ringo doesn't waste a lot of time. As Ringo said, if you're not in the room, you're not in the record. He's a firm believer in getting it done. You know, he doesn't think just like it's not like watching an elephant give birth. He wants to get it done. So,
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your singing, because obviously, you know, we're getting a taste of it on the new CD here, and it's just so wonderful to hear you. I mean, your voice is not only strong, but it's so durable. You do a very strong R&B voice, a great ballad voice and all. And a lot of people, they know that you've done background vocals through the years with Billy and with Foreigner and with the All-Stars. And when I got a taste of it during the last few tours, when you're backing up Steve Lukather on Africa and Rosanna, tell me about your singing. I mean, who are the people that you emulated as a singer, if any? Did you always want to try to be like an R&B singer?
Look, I love Wilson Pickett. I love Stevie Winwood, Paul Rodgers, Lou Gramm. I don't think I could shine any of their shoes, but those are the greatest singers that I love. Levi Stubbs from the Four Tops. I always grew up loving R&B. I just love the soul. I mean, I don't. I could never sing soft and quiet. My younger sister said, "You're a black man trapped in a white man's body." So, well, thank you. So it could be a lot worse. But I've always leaned towards R&B, and a lot of the record, I believe, and I proudly call it a record, is that it's a lot of emotional R&B, soulful. I mean, look, Hendrix. I mean, these are the people who I love, and even how I play saxophone. It's got to do with that. It's never been about jazz. It's been about rock and roll and soul.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a compliment to say that I have an R&B voice. But thank you for that.
You know, you could probably point to, I mean, there's so many great songs that Billy Joel has given us, but there's a lot that are very strong R&B. Are there certain songs, do you like a lot of, I mean, obviously you love Billy's catalog, but the ones that that I kind of point to as being R&B-esque, Until the Night, something like that.
Until the Night, well, my favorite Billy Joel song, as far as one of my favorite Billy Joel vocal performances, has to be All About Soul.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a killer vocal. I mean, she works for me at night. He's got this, like, undertone, and it's so convincing. It's so passionate. I love that song. Until the Night is another one of those. It's like the Righteous Brothers.
Right.
So you have this sense of black music, R&B music. And I mean, Billy would be the first one to tell you. I mean, this Billy's favorite band when he was a kid, I mean, the band that, I mean, aside from the Beatles, were the Rascals.
Mm-hmm.
And the Rascals were the first blue-eyed soul band. They were the bunch of Italian guys from the Bronx, and I think they're all from in that area, singing rock and roll, but soul.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was a kid, the record that the greatest, without sounding so nostalgic and old, my favorite year for music when I was a kid, I was 14 in 1967, and if you remember those quintessential records that came out, these are seminal records, Sgt. Pepper, Are You Experienced, the Collections album by the Rascals, Whiter Shade of Pale, and Fresh Cream. That was like a very, very fertile year as far as growth. I mean, I think, I'm trying to think when Santana came out. Was that about 68?
I think so.
Yeah, I think so.
Right around that time. And there was all this amazing music coming out. And if you think about the five records that I just mentioned, that was like a shotgun. Now we've got to pinpoint and pigeonhole songs into, we can't play that. It doesn't fit the format.
Right.
There was no format. They were guys who had a lot of nerve, had great ears, and weren't afraid to play something they loved. And there's a big difference, unfortunately. Again, I don't want to critique or criticize the music business, but you don't get that now.
You can critique it all you want with me.
Yeah, okay.
You're preaching to the choir.
Really are, because I feel the same way, Mark. I feel like, I feel like a lot of entertainment in general, movies especially, are all kind of focus group kind of situations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it really is, really, having grown, I mean, you were talking about 67. I mean, that was a great period, 68, too.
Mm-hmm,
actually,
the whole
middle 60s was absolutely astounding as far as music goes.
How about the Youngbloods?
Yeah.
Yep.
It was a time of peace and love. It was a great time. It was so fertile. And I'll tell you, with that point, Steve, Jimmy Brailauer pointed to me. He said, buddy, we need to do a record for people who are not being served. Great music. I mean, people from 45 to 65, where do they go for music? They hear I hate to say it, but they're hearing the same music over and over. And I have very dear friends who work in DJs in those formats, and they love my record, but they can't get past the gatekeeper to play it. So the crazy thing is, I really believe that Jimmy and I put together a record that if it gets heard, people are going to want to buy it. I I dig my record. I dig the fact that I have liner notes, that I put credits and did the whole thing. And I remember the first time. Well, my favorite Hendrix record is probably Axis. I remember the first time I opened that up and saw the picture in the middle, and I read every note, and Eddie Kramer was doing this. It was recorded at the record plant. It was insane. I knew it was just one of those things that you knew, and you dove into a record. People don't dive into it. I mean, people at this point, I hate to say people, for the most part, music is something that's done while you're either driving or on the computer doing something else.
Mm-hmm.
The experience of music, and I'm hoping, I hope I don't sound arrogant, but I hope this record is something that people actually sit down, because a couple of people said, they put the record on, and again, I keep referring to it as the record, they put it on, and they listened from start to finish, and it was like a 40-minute trip. It was like, because the songs move in different ways. I like that. I mean, I remember putting on a record, the only time you'd stop was when to turn it over.
Right.
That was it.
Well, Mark,
it was almost like a break because it's like, you know, so.
You should have listened to the last few shows that Steve and I have done, because you've been talking about radio and how different it is now. And it's more about marketing today than it is about the music and about the feel of the music and the experience of the music. And that's not to say that there isn't good music that's out there. But it's just, you are complaining, and rightfully so, about niche radio today, and where do you place certain artists? And it's very difficult, especially for veteran artists, to get airplay. So we've been talking about that for the last few shows.
Yeah.
And this fits right in with the conversation. And
I'll tell you, if you wouldn't mind, I mean, if you have a moment in the future, if you want to talk to somebody, I'd love for you to speak to and to meet my producer, Jimmy Brailauer. He would be a great guest.
Listen,
I
Mark.
I mean, he's got this depth. He's wonderful. And if you're interested in spending a half an hour with him, you guys should know him. His background, his insight. He worked at Atlantic Records for years, and he would come. Look, I'm not gonna throw stones too much, but he would hear great music, and it's like, oh no, it's not gonna fit. You know, where do you go? So. But I believe he'd be a great guest. And hey, hopefully this record gets heard, because it's my life. I won't say, like, you know, I'm not going to be impoverished, but I really would love for this record to at least see the light of day and give it a shot. You know, I'll leave you with one more thing, because Jimmy keeps his words resonating in my brain. Everything starts with Buddy. Buddy, if you hear Bruce Springsteen's South by Southwest keynote speech, you familiar with the one I'm talking about 2 years ago? Okay. Are you familiar, Steve?
A little bit, yeah.
Okay, if you get a chance, when this is just religion, man. Bruce Springsteen giving the keynote speech at South by Southwest, I think it's 2 years ago now. He talked about how the difference between current young people making music, in other words, if you own a computer, you're a producer. If you own a camera, you're a photographer. You know what I mean? If you have a guitar, you're a musician. He said, when we were kids, we didn't dream in our wildest dreams that we'd ever be even close to shining the shoes of these great people. And he cited Eric Burton as his influence for everything he ever wrote. We got to get out of this place was Born to Run. Everything that he ever played or ever wrote was something from an animal song. And it's really poignant to hear that because not enough people are willing to do the thousands of hours. How many shows do you think the Beatles did before they played the Ed Sullivan Show? Six? Mm-hmm.
Oh.
1,000? You know
yeah.
what I mean? Ringo tells me stories about how a windshield was blown out and they were driving through Germany for 5 hours with a hole in their windshield. They did everything. They did all their hard work. Forget the 10,000 hours. That was for real. Those guys, I'm reading In Time now Mark Levinson's book. Have you read that? I'm sure.
You mean Mark Lewison's book? Yeah.
I think it's Levinson. Thank you, Steve. that book. Yeah, right. Well, read that, right?
Yes.
Yeah. We both
it's
read it.
It's just incredible to see where these guys, how much of their blood and their lives they put into this. Mm-hmm. It wasn't an accident when they hit the Ed Sullivan Show and every eyeball in America, and that there was no crime when that happened.
Right.
It was just that time. But, I hope I don't go too far off on tangents, but when you ask me about, music and about what I think,
mm-hmm.
it's almost like, I hope you have your seatbelt on because it's going to be an e-ticket ride.
Oh, I think that would make that should be a separate show. And anytime you want to talk about it, because I wanted to discuss with you myself your feelings about the music industry today, because you've been in it for a long time. You've seen the good and the bad. You know, we're living in a digital age now, and things are so different from the way radio used to be. Radio is so niche-oriented now. And like I was saying, it's more about marketing. It's more about knowing who your audience is, who your demographics are. All that stuff has got to be put into all the thought behind it instead of just playing the music and enjoying it and experiencing it. Do you think we're better off or worse off for that reason?
I think it's a double-edged sword, honestly, Ken, because the technology, technologically speaking, we have the ability to do pretty much anything, but unfortunately, pretty much anything can go on the radio, or pretty much anything has the same shot. And there's a level of mediocrity that I don't like at all.
Mm-hmm.
There's some, if I could be so bold, there's some crap out there that in the 60s would never have been played. And we're going back at a time when Country Joe and the Fish were doing these trippy songs, but it's just some sappy crap that would never have seen the light of day. And again, it's this race for the race for the bottom, is it, or the race for the most lowest common denominator?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not up for that. I really believe. I'm telling you, we could have had this record out over a year ago, but Jimmy would not allow it. And I'll say it again. You have to get Jimmy on the show. You would love his insight. I just have to see if I could curtail his cynicism to some extent, so we don't totally alienate ourselves. But the guy is so incredibly knowledgeable, and everything they can about his production, I give it up to him. I raise my glass to him. This record would have been a good record, and I really, in all humility, I could say this to me is a great record because of his effort. So.
Okay.
I don't know when you might think about doing that, but
I'd like to have both of you guys back on together. I think that would be a great
idea. I would love that. In fact, what we could do is what I'd love to do would be to have possibly the two of us out of Jimmy's house in Long Island and maybe play some, if we could play little snippets of different things that he's done and with where germs came from the songs and how savvy this guy is.
Mm.
I've just barely scratched the surface with his credits. The two of us have played on, hundreds of millions of records. Honestly, hundreds of millions of records that have been sold with our name on it. is there a way we could consider doing this again? Steve, it would be a pleasure. Ken,
sure. Let me ask one more question about the album, because are you gonna do, besides the Cutting Room gig, are you gonna do any other promotional things for the album?
Absolutely. What I'm doing is every time we play in a big city, I'm gonna call it my Acela tour, because the Acela train goes from like Boston to Connecticut to New York to New Jersey to Philadelphia to D.C. And we're playing, we'll be playing Fenway Park, we'll be playing National Park in D.C., we'll be playing a park at Lincoln, I think it's Lincoln Field in Philly. What I want to do is every one of those cities, I want to go in with a band and have them get on a train the night after or the night, probably two nights before or the night after. Probably the night after Billy's show would be the best, because there's so much stuff going on before. But I want to go in there and go into radio stations. I want to go and do live stuff. In fact, you gentlemen know Mike Marone, right?
I know the name from XM and Sirius. Yes.
Mike has championed this record. He's played five or six songs already from this record. He loves this record, and he wants me to come down and do a show with the band down there. And I'll do a gig in D.C. at the same time. I'll go do a gig in Philly. So the short answer to your question, Steve, is, yes, I will be doing a bunch of promotional gigs. I can't call it a tour, because it's impossible for me to say I'm going to just put a whole machine together and do a tour, because of the fact that I'm working with Billy. And again, that's the greatest, again, the champagne problem, as Nils would say, to have, because while Billy's out doing his thing, I'm able to do some radio, some press, and God willing, get out there and play in front of some people. I mean, it's a wonderful, wonderful vehicle being on this tour. We're playing, we'll be playing a couple of gigs to like 65, 70,000 people. And if a slight awareness could be generated from my record, I'd be one of the happiest people on this earth.
Okay. Well, we wish you the best of luck, Billy. Mark, we wish you the best of luck, Mark. It's a wonderful record, and anyone that hasn't heard it, Ken and I have both reviewed it, and we both love it, and we both give it a high recommendation.
I thank you both so much for your kindness, and you know what? There are people who are still listening, and that makes me very, very happy. So we'll figure out a time when we can do this again.
Mark, thanks so much for joining us, and we will have you back again soon, and hopefully with Jimmy.
You got it. And again, gentlemen, the Beatles songs, the things you said today, one of my favorite ever, and you know that. God bless you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay.
Thank you, Steve. It's a pleasure.
Okay.
Bye-bye. All right. This has been great.
That was a wonderful conversation. I enjoyed that immensely.
Yeah. Great to have Mark Rivera with us. I'm Ken Michaels for Things We Said Today, thanking you all for listening, and we'll see you next time.
And this is Steve Marinucci for Things We Said Today, saying thank you, Mark Rivera, and we will see you next time.